Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio on blogtalkradio.com. It is Wednesday, March 30th, 2022. We are in the new, beautiful, luxury, remodeled Electric Hankland Studios, which was remodeled by my dear wife. It's looking good, a bit cluttered, but looking good. It's got Hawkeye paraphernalia on some of the walls. It's got pictures of the family. It's got even got a little Hawkeye beanie baby, Herky beanie baby that's really cool. It's awesome. It's really nice in here. And a craft room as well, and a refrigerator. It's got a refrigerator. No beer in it right now. But anyway, yeah, Mrs. Hank is here in the house, and she redesigned the Electric Hankland studio. It's quite awesome, really. Other shows on Global Patriot Radio, although they don't generate from Electric Hankland, Monday nights, 6 p.m. Eastern, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al. Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern, Eric with the Cross and Crescent Discussion. And then Wednesday nights, of course, me, Hank Jones at 5:30 Eastern. And then Thursdays at 6 o'clock Eastern, we have Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, we swerve a bit. We go till noon or go at noon on Fridays, noon Eastern time with Andrew Herod and Conservative Casual Friday. Saturday nights, it gets even more off the clock, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern time. That is when you hear Revealing the Truth About Islam with Minister Usama Daktuk and the beautiful Christie. Sundays, again, off time a bit, 3 p.m. Eastern time. Eric is back doing a second run with Real Interfaith Dialogue. So yeah, you can set your watch by us for the most part. You can't set it for the same time every day. And then if you're a different time zone, then it's really messed up. Like Sue from New Mexico, she's out obviously in New Mexico. Indie Hawk KB is in the chat room. I think if he's in, well, there's a line in Indiana. Some of it's Eastern, some of it's not. And then we got T. Bodie on the, he's in the Central time zone. So yeah, we've got multiple time zones. Our second guest today, we'll be calling from California, so that's way out of town. I mean, that's way, way out there. So, hey, if you want to interact with the show, of course, as I mentioned, the chat room with Indie Hawk right now, you just come into the website, find us, and go to the chat room. I believe it's best if you have an account, but you don't have to, I don't think. You can also just listen that way. You don't have to go in the chat room. You can just listen online at blogtalkradio.com and then find Global Patriot Radio under Live. Or you can call in 319-527-6706, and that is how Sue from New Mexico is doing it. It's how T. Bodie's in right now. Again, 319-527-6706. Now, if you ever want to email me during the week, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. I don't get much. I don't do much. But, you know, if you send me something, I'll reply. You can also go onto Facebook and just look up Hank Jones Poly Sports. Don't do much there. Like I've said before, I really go to Facebook so that I can play Candy Crush and laugh at some of the people, laugh at my liberal friends, of course. I don't have a lot of liberal friends, but the ones I do, I laugh at them. Absolutely. And then, of course, Twitter, @HPolySports. And that's a really, I mean, I go there because I find out what's going on as much as I do. You know, I put out my showrunner, but other than that, it's just a good place to go and hear what's going on and hear people's different slants on it. Or you can do like what Holger and I did today and went after Robert Reich a little bit. Yeah, that Robert Reich. Yeah, the Robert Reich that wants to put us in camps. The very one. Okay, so what's going on? Well, we've got some obits this week. Last Thursday, we lost Gil Stein, former NHL president. He was age 94. And then we lost Kirk Baptiste. Now, if that name sounds somewhat familiar, Kirk Baptiste was an American sprinter. He won the silver medal in the 200 meters in 1984 behind Carl Lewis. He was the first person to break 20 seconds in a 200 meter while losing the race. He eventually went on later that summer to set an unofficial record at 300 meters. It was a race that Lewis was trying to set the record, and Kirk Baptiste ended up doing it. He then fell onto hard times, including some major drug abuse, in needle type drugs. He was diagnosed with HIV in the 1990s. He's 59. Yikes. Friday, American R&B singer Keith Martin's body was discovered in his Philippines apartment. No cause of death. 55. And then also we lost rock drummer Taylor Hawkins, most notably of the Foo Fighters, but he also played with Sass Jordan, Alanis Morissette. That was earlier in his career. He also had some side projects of his own. He was touring South America with the Foo Fighters. He was due to play that night in Bogota, Colombia at the Estero Picnic Festival. Emergency services apparently were called to his hotel room. He was reported to be suffering chest pain. And then when they arrived, I guess he was unconscious and unresponsive. They did CPR. He was declared dead at the scene. Yeah, the next day, preliminary toxicology reports from urine tests revealed he had as many as 10 substances in his system. That's tough. Saturday, we lost country singer Jeff Carson to a heart attack at age 58. Jeez. He had several hits on the charts. One of them, Not On Your Love, reached number one. He actually retired from country music in 2009 and became a full-time police officer with the Franklin, Tennessee Police Force outside, right outside of Nashville. That's where C.J. Beathard is from, actually, you Hawkeye fans. Sunday, we lost William Boulware Jr., known in the wrestling world as Rocky King. Rocky King was just 62. He was actually homeless when he started hanging around wrestling shows by Jim Crockett Promotions, the old NWA, in 1985. Befriended several of the NWA Crockett Promotion wrestlers, came known as a jobber, taking squash losses for up-and-coming wrestlers, both heel and babyface. And then he actually became what's known as sort of a big-time jobber. He's allowed to show offense and skills in his matches. He often wrestled against Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen. And then after Crockett Promotions sold to Ted Turner and became WCW, he employed a gimmick character, Little Richard Marley. And that's where he managed the Fabulous Freebird duo Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin. And then they turned on him, attacked him after he cost them a match, and subsequently went back to Rocky King. He became a referee before he retired from WCW in 1998. After that, he started his own promotion, which was sort of geared to putting on shows for family audiences, for churches or nonprofit groups up and down the East Coast. He also paired with Bill Hurd of Atlanta's Bill Hurd Chevrolet to promote Kids Night Out. And that was a program to help keep kids off the street. So how about a silent 10 count for William Rocky King Boulware Jr.? Yeah, good guy. Fun guy to watch. Monday, we lost American director Marvin Chomsky. He died in his sleep at age 92. He had a rather versatile career, I would say. Directed the 1971 biopic, Evel Knievel. It was called Evel Knievel, with George Hamilton. And then he did Tank with James Garner in 1984. Did TV episodes, Star Trek, Gunsmoke, Wild Wild West. Actually did some series of Roots, the miniseries Roots in 1977. He also directed a movie called Brotherhood of the Rose that was based on the novel by former University of Iowa professor David Morrell. David Morrell also created the character of Rambo, wrote the book First Blood. And then yesterday we lost actor Paul Herman on his 76th birthday. He's probably best known for his roles like in Goodfellas and The Sopranos. He was in Casino, The Irishman. He's actually in Once Upon a Time in America, and also one of my favorite movies, The Pope of Greenwich Village. He's a fun actor, really. He played those small but kind of crucial roles that helped set the background and the setting for the films he played. You know, like in Goodfellas, I think he was in the group at the beginning, and when Henry Hill's talking about the guys that show up at the pizzeria, or he might have been at the barbecue or whatever, but you know he had the accent down, and you know, it just gave you that feel of what mob life was like in their little enclaves. Hey, before we get to news, I'm going to do a little ad, a little shout-out for some friends of mine at a company called Alliance Communication Center. They're a 24-hour call center and messaging service based out of Central Florida, but they serve all over the country, even internationally, I think. They provide a full range of call center type services, straightforward after hours answering and messaging to dispatch. They do detailed response service type things for hospitals, government agencies, real estate management, pretty much anything that requires people to answer calls and manage your communications. Okay, are you a small or medium-sized company, doesn't want to staff 24 hours, but you need to be covered 24 hours, you know, a plumber, electrician, whatever? Or maybe you got a special project, like a campaign that needs a fully staffed call center to gather information or responses, surveys, whatever, across the country. Or this is more common, maybe you're one of those companies that's determined you're never going back to your traditional office. And you need a way for your incoming calls to be answered on the front line so you and your staff can manage the actual business in the trenches. Well, you're not alone. You're really not. And the management and staff at Alliance Communications can help you. Call them, 800-555-3738. That's old school, 800-555-3738. Remember those 800-555 numbers? Let them do just that. Let them help you. And also, if you're looking for a great place to do remote work, if you have call center skills, give them a call. They do, you know, projects all over. They can you can log in and help out and work remotely with them. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or check them out, alliancecommunications.com. I know them. I know them. I've worked with them. Most of all, I trust them. I really do. So let them earn your trust. They're great folks. They do great work and fun people to talk to. Fun guys. One I consider a friend. I've known him for 30 years. Just a great guy. And so let's get to the news. The Oscars were given out last Sunday. Now, I couldn't tell you most of who won or what most of the nominated movies were about or are about. I couldn't tell you who the hell most of the individual nominees actually are. But I do know, as of Sunday morning and before that night's awards, several of the celeb types were, supporting, taking up the cause of Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky, including Amy Schumer and two-time Oscar winner Sean Penn. And it gives me reason to think that the recent smearing of Zelensky, President Zelensky, by both sides, it's not only sad, but honestly, it's kind of scary. Why? I'll tell you why. Because we have people in this country, a country that in its founding purpose was the very model of freedom, that are besmirching the president of a country who chose to stay behind while his country is being invaded. He had several opportunities to leave, and he's staying behind. It's scarier still, though, that not only some in Hollywood are choosing to stick by him, but that they're right. Scariest, though, they're right, and I agree with them. Okay, sure. They're only doing it, some of them, because Big Left as a whole, I think, is sticking with Zelensky. But in this case, Big Left, yeah, I'm sure, yeah, we can find all kinds of things about President Zelensky that are not as wholesome as some believe themselves to be. Sure, he was, quote, just an actor. Remember that? Guess what? Remember, Ronald Reagan was just an actor at one point. In the history of our country, people, we have had actors, we have had athletes, business people, doctors, clergy, even housewives. And I say even, especially housewives, who have become elected leaders, local, regional, whatever, national in some cases. Some have been good, some haven't. But in this country, it's possible. It's still possible. Now, yeah, it's tougher, obviously, on a national level to get elected as, quote, an outsider. But it's still possible. So, yeah, before any of you, no matter your personal beliefs, start going after President Zelensky or past corruption in Ukraine, or you note that it was once part of the Soviet Union, just stop. Look, man, our country lauded the knocking down of the Berlin Wall. We hailed the breakup of the Soviet Union. You know, we love the return of all those little small independent nations. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine, in basic principle, is wrong. Now, if you're asking different questions, should we have boots on the ground? Not yet, not in my opinion. At least not until, I mean, if they attack or invade a NATO ally, then that's a different story. Should we be sending weapons? I'd love to say no. But frankly, us doing that is ultimately what helped Afghanistan repel the Soviets back in the 1980s and probably what helped them repel us. Shouldn't say repel us, but gave us cause to walk away. Point is really this. Stop looking for reasons to denigrate Zelensky, and for God's sake, stop deluding yourself that Putin isn't a bad guy or worse, isn't in the wrong here. Stop with the crap of history will look positively on this or will smile on that. Bottom line, look, one country is aggressively attacking and invading another free, independent country. That's wrong. Here, though, we get to the really scary part. I agree on something with Sean Penn. I know, I can't believe it either. This is the same Sean Penn who said, America lost a true friend with the death of Venezuelan dictator, plunderer Hugo Chavez. Here's another one about the Oscars. I ain't going to virtue signal like everyone else, and I'm not going to tell everyone that Will Smith was wrong or Chris Rock was wrong. Look, Will Smith apologized. Good for him. Chris Rock owes no apologies, nor is he spouting off about the incident. Really, you know, the sooner everyone lets it go, the sooner we can either let the Oscars die, as they have become or are becoming, or they'll have no choice but to go back to being a group that rewards and recognizes excellent work versus just being 500 or 1,000 people all sitting around together being morally and ethically self-righteous. Look, if it comes to which of those is going to happen, I know where I'd put my money if it came to betting on those things. So, but anyway, that's enough about the Oscars. Some sports news. We have a Final Four. We do. And damn if it doesn't look a hell of a lot like Final Fours of years past. If there is an outsider, and there really isn't, it would be Villanova, the number two seed out of the South region. They joined Duke, who's the West region's number two seed, Midwest number one Kansas, and number eight UNC, North Carolina, out of the East region. Maybe more surprising are the teams that didn't even make the Elite Eight, like overall number one seed Gonzaga in the West or number three Purdue in the East. Yeah, Purdue went down to number 15 seed St. Peter's in the Sweet 16. Or in the South, number one Arizona went down to five seed Houston. But, you know, yeah, with a Sweet 16 that had three double-digit seeds, you had number 10 Miami, Florida, and number 11 Iowa State joining St. Peter's. You had the hope one might make the Final Four. Really, once Miami took out Iowa State, it left them playing number one Kansas. But I figured kind of with 15 St. Peter's taking on number eight UNC, I thought there was still hope. And until there wasn't. Until there wasn't, basically. Kansas took down Miami by 26. UNC pretty much shattered the St. Peter's glass slipper with their 20-point win. Well, there's that. In Iowa basketball news, the Hawkeyes got some nut punches yesterday and another one today. Yesterday, All-American and National Player of the Year candidate Keegan Murray officially declared from the draft. That's really surprised no one. But then backup point guard and seemingly next year's number one point guard, Joe Toussaint, entered the transfer portal. Sorry, I throw that one 100% on Coach Fran McCaffrey. The lineup switch made during the season made a difference, but when it came to the NCAA tournament, your best defending guard saw very few minutes. And then your stupid comments about your son Patrick being the one to watch for next year pretty much said defense, who needs defense? As a consequence, you've lost your best perimeter defender. And then today, Josh Ogundele announced that he is entering the transfer portal. Now, he's had some injury and health issues. But he seemed to be coming out of it. He had some good minutes against Purdue in the Big Ten tournament championship game. But it's just it's unfortunate. But it happens now. It's a transfer portal, and I'm going to have to deal with it. This week's first Laffy, that would be AOC. She's kind of a perennial Laffy, I guess, but yeah, this week's first Laffy, AOC threatening SCOTUS, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, with resign or face impeachment. Yeah. Resign or face impeachment. I really see that going well for her. I really do. This week's second Laffy, although it's kind of frightening too, Mittens Romney with his statement, if Trump wins in 2024, NATO would rethink its U.S. relationship. Now, that's a B-sharps kind of Laffy for any of you devotees of The Simpsons. Remember the episode with the B-sharps? In other words, it's really funny at first, and then it gets less funny as you ponder the actual statement. Then in late news, Joe got his second booster, his fourth total COVID shot. He said he felt great. I'm not sure if they gave him a lollipop after, but he also used the time to announce the rollout of a new website, COVID.gov, what the La Dopey Nostra is calling a, quote, one-stop shop, unquote, for tests, vaccines, treatments, and other info. Bear in mind, this guy was part of an administration that spent billions on a healthcare website that they couldn't get built properly or on time. So, yeah, look into this website. As Bruno Kirby's character said in Tin Man, I can't wait to see it. We'll see. We'll see. Guest interviews today. Got a couple guests. We got two today. I've known my first guest since college, the glory days in Iowa City, Chuck Long, Hayden Fry, and the football team, the latter days of Lute Olson basketball. We did parties at night. We went tubing on the Iowa River with the remains of a keg when that party was over. And, of course, we listened to a lot of music, watched the early days of MTV. Now he is one of the leaders of Celebration. That's an event in Fort Dodge, Iowa, which will celebrate its 20th anniversary at their event this summer. Welcome my old friend and crew charter member, critiquer, T. Bodie, to the program. What's up, friend?
Yo, Hank, how are you?
Good, how are you,
can
man?
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Good, good. You hear me okay? All right. Yeah. I'm doing good. It's back to working gigs during the week, so when I'm not working, I'm pretty much resting and relaxing as best I can to recover.
Cool. So have you been all involved all 20 years?
With Celebration as it – no. I got involved in 2004. We moved back from Colorado to Iowa, and that was its. This is our 20-year anniversary. That would have been about the fourth or fifth year. The guy who's president of the association, Jim Reed, was a friend of mine growing up from back to kindergarten, first grade. But we lost touch over the years. He was an Iowa Stater, and then he went to grad school to Iowa. So he's still a Hawk fan, but nonetheless, he. Had the Beach Boys come that year, and it got rained out. In fact, in the laurels of staging events around here, a lot of people are familiar with the fact that they got like 25 inches of rain or something over the course of 2 days, and speakers and amplifiers floating, and instruments were floating, and they did it on a beach at a lake outside of Fort Dodge, Iowa, and the show had to be canceled. No one took the stage, of course, and kind of a flash flood situation. And they brought him back, though, a month later. The Beach Boys came back, and I called up Jim, and I said, dude, he just brought the Beach Boys to little old Fort Dodge, Iowa. What's going on? And he had prior to that Little River Band and Head East and a Beatles tribute band. And, you know, I started out in a small band, and just every year we've just built it up. I asked him how I could get involved, and he said, yeah, you know, you can help build the stage next year. And oh, that's cool. Little did I realize how grunt that was.
So how did he get the idea? What prompted him to do it? Did he ever tell you or just?
He started out with organization here that does, if you're familiar with dragon boat racing.
Yeah, absolutely. We support so one with our Kiwanis Foundation.
Yeah, okay. So the Rotary Club here was in charge of it, and then they still are very active and involved in that, and they've had the international regionals here at Kennedy Lake and in Fort Dodge, outside of Fort Dodge. Anyhow, Jim was a part of that, and they brought in Grand Funk Railroad down on the river.
Oh, okay.
And that was back in, like, 2000, maybe it was 2001. As part of that event. And then Jim saw a opportunity there, and of course, learning the rigmaroles of how to book the band and how to put on the event, and kind of took it from there. He did a couple of small. He did a Springsteen tribute band back then called Ricochet, and some other similar type, smaller, you know, regional, national acts, one a year, two a year, and then okay. It just really got bigger. So he brought it was a board when I joined it. So I did the staging the first 2 years that I got involved. 2006 was like the I don't know the Doobie Brothers, and then the following year I think we had Chicago, and
wow.
Did the staging for those. Then the next year they did. We had the Guess Who and 38 Special was the headliner, and the 38 Special got caught up in a rainstorm in Georgia and couldn't make their flight to get to our stage. So we fortunately had the Guess Who lined up, and they moved them as the headliner, brought up another support act and locally, and they lost their ass. And so that's about the time they brought me on. You know, it was like, hey, Ted, you've been following us and helping out and seem to have a love of music. And I, you know, attended a gazillion concerts in my life. And
sure.
Thought, yeah, sure, let me get involved. And so we turned and righted the ship. I don't remember who the following year we went out to back. This whole project started out as kind of a fundraiser for a band shell in Fort Dodge, which needed some restoration. It needed a couple million dollars worth of restoration, not the $10,000 or $20,000 in excess money that was generated. But it got made awareness, and the project eventually did get done. But they moved away from that, and they took the concert out to the local soccer fields here. Fort Dodge is host to the Iowa High School Girls State Softball Tournament.
Okay.
And so they have a real nice complex there. So just to finish up on that, they brought it out there and had a couple of the 3 years out there after having the first couple at the band shell. We downsized it just a little bit by scale of event, went back to the band shell that next year and brought on REO Speedwagon. And REO, I've worked kind of as a consultant beyond this now for other festivals, and REO is one of those bands that people love, people follow. They don't cost much. Even though people have seen them a lot, they still go back to them. It's a great kind of starter band if you're trying to think about starting a concert or a festival in your area.
Okay.
As far as getting a name brand, I mean, there's some others, too, that are a little smaller because you just don't want to jump in with 2 feet. There's a lot of moving parts to putting on a concert and then moving it into a festival. So we went from that. We did 3 years out at the band shell, which we made money, but we were only able to get about 6,000 people in the venue.
Okay.
We did REO. Foreigner was a kind of a rain-impacted event, but they still put on a full performance after the rain. You know, they started at 10 o'clock instead of at 8:30 or something. But and then Styx. And then we following year, we moved it back out to the soccer fields. And Leonard Skinner in Boston and I don't know, each year we had Huey Lewis, Steve Miller Band.
Damn, you've gotten some really good acts. So how is this funded then? How do you get them funds to, I mean, I assume these bands aren't free.
No, they're not. And most of them, you can't really, rely on your ticket sales and say, okay, we sold this many tickets, now we'll pay you, because the bands usually need at least 50% down or up front within 30 days of the event, and sometimes sooner of signing. So we use sponsors, and we've built up our sponsorship level to this year, being our 20th year. We, as of today, we just started our sponsorship sales because we just made the announcement of the event a week ago on last Friday night. Our tickets went on sale. We announced on Wednesday. The tickets went on sale on Friday. Right now, our event for this year is running second to our most popular event, which was ZZ Top. 4 years ago, and ZZ Top was actually a rain-impacted event, but our sponsorship dollars were the highest for our Boston event.
Okay.
And we are probably going to surpass that event this year. We're only at $10,000 shy. So we got these sponsors. We get in anywhere from $110,000 to $130,000 in $1,000, $2,500, and $5,000 increments.
Okay, so in other words, somebody's got – somebody's like, as an example, so like a gold sponsor, XYZ
yep.
Incorporated,
yep.
And then they get like what, like a ticket package, that kind of thing?
Yep. Yep. So we have a really nice VIP tent that we serve a catered meal and free six free drink tickets anyhow, and, you know, covered seating and the like. At times we've had preferred parking, So they get, limited depending on the number, 2, 6, or 12 of those VIP tickets. But then they get a handful of maybe 40 or 60 or what, 80 of the general admission tickets. In fact, plus they get all sorts of radio play, all our print media. They get their logo on. They get the radio play from we use upwards of, gosh, I don't know the number, and I'd be guessing if I said it, but probably upwards of 60 radio stations as media trade partners. And we trade.
Wow.
You know how you can win tickets on the radio? We'll trade out the equipped number of tickets at the market value for that particular amount of radio advertising.
Okay.
And we don't have cash. We are a nonprofit organization, so we
sure.
We kind of just say, hey, you know, we'll trade you the tickets if you can run the ads. And so we run ads in Minnesota, Illinois, Omaha area, KRNA and KGGO are two big stellar radio stations out of Des Moines and Iowa City and the Waterloo
right.
station. And so they run their ads and they give away their tickets, and a lot of their DJs and management have actually come up to our show, and that's how we know that we've gotten a lot of feedback that we're one of the best well-run events that they've ever attended multiple times. So we have the banks as our partner, you know, each of the different banks around town, the printing companies, the, you know, auto sellers. And so we've got a list now of probably, I don't know, 60 or 70, it might be more of sponsors. And so they get on that print media, they get in the radio media, and they're on the back of the tickets, they're on the posters, the newspapers. And with that gives us that seed money that we can put on the event. So we know that we can at least get the band paid. And then we have ticket sales. And with all those tickets that we give away to the radio stations,
right.
We get return. I mean, people say, oh, I won tickets. You know, you want to go with us? And so that's where that comes in. And we get probably about four. It's not about, because it's between 39 and 42% every single year return back on our comp tickets. It's really crazy how it's not 50% or 30%. Although last year COVID had something to do with it, I think. And we only got like 20% came back. But, you know, I think people didn't want to travel quite as much then and such.
Yeah.
But we saw numbers were fairly good for last year's show. So this year, the money's there and people are coming
back.
So
you've given me some good headliners of years past, and you've had some really stellar acts. I mean, they may not be the headliners of today, but they're still impactful. I mean, Chicago, as an example, is still touring, you know, I mean, very actively touring.
And so last year we had Cheap Trick, and 38 Special ended up opening for Cheap Trick, or not opening, they're direct support. We always, we always have a local band open up our show, which is kind of cool because there's some great musicians in Iowa and in more closer in our local area, so it's kind of a big resume builder for some of these bands. We have a list of people that, you know, just want us to come preview them. You know, you feel like you're a big time promoter when you go into a bar and they see you and they know who you are. And all of a sudden, you know, hey, how are you? Let me buy you a drink.
Yeah, that is cool.
They want to play on our stage, and it's kind of fun. I'm kind of in charge of that and finding some of these bands. I've seen a lot of them. Last year, I said we had Cheap Trick. 2 years ago, or actually the year before the COVID year, we did not participate in 2020.
Right.
But in 2019, we had Sammy Hagar and Vince Neil from Motley Crue opened up before his voice went really south. And so we kind of got lucky because he's kind of hit or miss. But ZZ Top, you know, those are the most recent ones. So this year we ended up, and it's, you know, we're pretty transparent. We're nonprofit, so we talk about our numbers openly. We show what numbers, how many people are in our venues and what we're selling, how much we're making. And, you know, figure if we are transparent, we have nothing to hide, we have nothing to hide.
Right.
So this year, you know, every year we do a poll, or we've done plenty of polls, you know, who do you want to come here? And Journey and Def Leppard are always right at the top of that. Journey and Def Leppard go for, generally they used to go for about $400,000 for the show. That's just for the band. Usually you got another anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000 for the stage and the video and the front of house and your production, which is your sound and light. And
you're a half million. You're in upside down from the get go on that one, obviously.
Yeah, we would have to upgrade our ticket prices, and I think our sponsorship would jump up big time for those. The band, so those are the two highest ranking ones, and then it drops down to almost all the others. We've got it kind of broken down into three tiers. But that being said, we've made offers to those two bands every year for the last 4 or 5 years now. You know, we're not afraid of them. We've got money that we've built up in our bank account,
okay.
And we made the offer for one reason or another. We haven't been able to get them. We've made offers of up to as much as $500,000 just for Journey this past year. Well, I say up to five. It was $475,000. They're getting $400,000. The problem is they packaged up to go on a trip to play over in Europe all summer with Toto.
Okay.
And so they get these Live Nation tours that they package up, and instead of getting that $500,000, they're getting $1 million.
Yeah.
Each band's getting twice what they normally get. And so they take those package deals, and, you know, that's why even in our industry, if you're an independent, you don't like Live Nation and AEG and some of these other larger conglomerates. Because
right,
they do
right.
that to you. You can't get to your Journey. We would really want to do it. So we started calling, you know, and then this is like a year ago, or not a year ago, but 8 months ago. And then you get closer, and most of these don't fall into place till November, December, most of the tours. And it became very aware that bands weren't going to tour that much in America in 2022, going into the festival season and concert season, that a lot of them were going over doing Europe and packaging up, or they weren't touring at all. And so we were, you know, making offers to other bands, John Fogerty, Kenny Loggins, I can't think of a couple. We ended up making five offers. We hadn't even thought about Bret Michaels, although that Poison was on our radar as a band. Poison's pulled pretty well. They're going out on this big stadium tour with Motley Crue and Joan Jett and Def Leppard starts 5 days after our show. Their
okay.
first date, I think, is in Atlanta. And, you know, so we didn't really think about it, and then it kind of fell in our lap. And so we got, and we kind of had Molly Hatchet. So we got Molly Hatchet leading into Bret Michaels this year. And
okay.
Molly Hatchet kind of, we went and previewed them about 3 years ago, 4 years ago at the surf, legendary surf ballroom up in Clear Lake, where that's where Buddy Holly died.
Yeah, exactly.
Crashed. The surf ballroom's real famous. Everyone wants to play there. So we went up and saw Molly Hatchet, and they actually still put on a pretty good show. And even, they lost every member in that band. They've lost over the years since they were, you know, they're 50 years into it. They started in like 1973 or something.
Right, right. Yeah,
however, they still got one guy who's from 1984 that's been with them since then. And they've had, you know, many different members, but the current lineup they've got three of those guys have now been with them for like 20 years.
Okay.
And so anyhow, they're pretty cheap by comparison. We're able to pick them up for $20,000 or $25,000, you know, $30,000. All those ranges are pretty low for bands like that. And so, yeah, that's, you know, we're able to get them for a fairly decent price. And then Brett Michaels fell on our lap, and, you know, it's four or five times higher for him because
sure.
of his Poison fame. And the guy is a rock star. I mean, he, if you think about Brett Michaels in The Rock of Love and
yeah.
Celebrity Apprentice, he did that. They had to do that Snapple contest, come up with a Snapple flavor.
Sure.
And he donated all the proceeds to diabetes because he's diabetic. He has raised, I think, $600,000 for the for his organization and won that year. He hosted the Miss America, and then of course his Rock of Love show.
Yeah.
He hosted Miss Universe pageant. Rock of Love show. He's got a Rock My RV coming out this year on TV. He's just a self-promoter. It's
oh yeah,
amazing.
I'd say that. But he's good at it. He's very good at it.
If you ever see an interview with him, he's very genuine. He's down, you know, he's this rock star that's down to earth.
Sure.
You know,
I think most of them are more down to earth than we give them credit for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, you see these writers from all these bands over the years. You know, my wife helps. She runs our hospitality tent for the band Hospitality.
Okay.
And so she's catering backstage only to the bands. And, she handles. We have to get all the things they ask for their buses. You kind of bus stock, and you have to supply those buses. And you've got the just the things they want on hand, and then you got to provide meals. Or sometimes you give them, the bands will take what they call a buyout, and just you give them a check for whatever, how much, you know, like a per diem per member that's in touring with them, and they just order from a menu and
okay.
have it delivered in. Either way, you still get this rider list, you know, and you always hear about the Van Halen, you know, we want no green M&Ms, pull out, or we only want green M&Ms. I don't remember what it was, but to make sure people read these riders. I give you an example of a lot of these, and maybe, and you think of these rock stars as having, you know, they can get any beer or liquor they want on these shows. And Leonard Skinner, I always, you know, you talk about, you know, they were the partiers, and of course, after their plane accident and such, they're on their rider list. Was only one bottle of Jack Daniels. That was the only alcohol in the entire thing, and it was so they could gargle with and take a shot or two for their throat.
Really?
Brett Michaels, I think on that list there's 2 6-packs of specialty beer and, you know, a couple cases of pop and a couple cases of seltzer or something. And, you know, you just, there's not that much alcohol on their rider list anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be, take that back. Sometimes there's 4 or 5 cases, you know, they ask for, and you got to do it.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So we'll what's the day and date for this year's event?
So June 11th, Saturday, we always try to get on a Saturday or a Friday is our first choice of date because for obvious reasons, our organization, so we're Saturday, June 11th. And our tickets, like I said, just went on sale. So it's kind of a short window for us. Usually we like 4 months, and we only got 3 to get our sponsors lined up, to get our tickets lined up and out there selling. And right now we're second only to that ZZ Top show in ticket sales for the first week of sales. And our sponsorship dollars only is second to our highest, which was Boston.
Okay.
So we're feeling really good about what we've got going on this year. It's the other thing that kind of stands out is the females that obviously love Brett Michaels, you know, handsome,
yeah.
personable guy, you know, rock star mentality, good looks, what have you. And our Facebook post, we stoked the fire there on Facebook under Shellebration. It's, you know, like,
sure,
like a seashell celebration, as the play with the name came because of that band Shell that we tried to fix. Anyhow, so Shellebration, our webpage, or our Facebook page, is, I want to say it's like 80% women that have responded this year. Usually it's all the guys. Yeah, great show. All great. We'll be there. And
yeah,
they're all, hey, what are you doing? We're girls night out, this and that and the other thing. And, you know, when we put out our initial post, it's people look forward to it. And this one, I don't think we've quite got to 80,000 views, but it's awfully close right now. That ZZ Top one was our biggest one. It was viewed by 240,000 people. But it gets shared, you know, 1,500 times, 2,000 times. And the algorithms of Facebook, and they change every 6 months. But we're getting some really good love from that. We don't have a website. We do, but we don't use our website because Facebook just seems to be so much easier to put out the information. Brett Michaels put together a video that he, you know, the guy's a self-promoter. He puts out a video that we put out there that says, hey, man, I'm coming to Fort Dodge, Iowa. We're going to do Shellebration, and it's going to be a party. I want you all to come out and join me. And, you know, we never had a do that for us. So that's pretty cool. You know, the whole, and I'm not getting a chance to ask a question or two because there's just so much information to spew out.
Oh, no, I know. But, you know, so let me ask you this. You know, obviously live music has started to come back. But, you know, you guys have your events. But are there venues around, either around Iowa or around, you know, like you mentioned the Surf Ballroom or whatever. Are there venues that aren't going to make it back post-COVID,
you think? There are around the world. The big question was, and, of course, as we entered 2022, because last year, 2021, there was a lot of festivals, and it was what's going to happen going into the winter. And the indoor stuff. And that kind of followed suit that I, you know, as you know, I work as stagehand and help set up and rig concerts at many venues around the region, the five-state region. I've worked every festival around this area. In fact, the guys I normally work with are going out to Coachella next week for a month to do that, and Stagecoach out in California. We do set up for a lot of shows. I just worked Elton John last week. I worked.
Man, you're dropping some serious names here.
I did Elton John on Saturday, and on Monday did, I can't even remember the name, Korn, the heavy metal band Korn.
Okay.
And we did Mott Fest with Slipknot. Of course, that's an Iowa product, but they had, attendance down in Des Moines there, about 35,000 last October, and that was a big event. That was the largest stage, actually one of the largest stages that I've ever seen, but one of the largest stages that the company that does the staging ever set up. It was 360 feet long and 80 feet deep. You know, it was two side-by-side openings so that you could bring on a band and the other one's taken off, and had a loading dock and back that could back up 12 semis too. And that was quite the thing. But so I work all these festivals, and I'm very familiar with some of the venue managers and owners by my nature of being involved with Shellebration. And so I get the numbers and hear out of them. And, you know, like Elton John, that was sold out. Korn was sold out, and they were full. Eric Church 3 weeks ago, sold out and full. This is in Des Moines at Wells Fargo, so, you know, 15,000 people. 6 months ago, trying to do those shows, and a lot of shows, and it was kind of across the country. They would sell out, but 20% of the people wouldn't show up.
Okay.
You know, they just had the tickets. You got your people that had bought in tickets, and some of these events were postponed from 2020 and 2021. And so people that had tickets might not have gone. But the bottom line is that vendors and merchandise sales suffered by it because they were down 20% as well. So the smaller venues aren't able to cover as well because you got a lot of costs associated with the show. even with a fixed venue of some of these smaller permanent venues. Cost right now for this year, and so going into this year, it was the big question is, what are students who have been mask shamed all year long and on campuses, are they going to come out for concerts and festivals? You know, the football stadiums are selling out, but what are the kids doing?
Yeah.
That was, you know, the question 2-3 months ago. In fact, in January, you had a bunch of cancellations. The Ukraine situation, as John Fogerty, we didn't get him because he was going to go over to Europe, canceled his tour over in Europe this spring and summer because of the Ukraine situation.
So what happens to these? What happens to these people? I mean, you know, we've seen recently, like Bob Dylan, David Crosby, and others sell their catalogs, and what we're hearing is that, you know, over the last couple of years, they've had no tour revenue. So what happens to these guys? You know, what's happened to some of these? I mean, I ask you about venues, but are there acts and groups that aren't going to come back from COVID? I mean, as an example, are there bands that are just going to shut it down and go off and do different projects because of that?
I don't think so, because there's a gazillion bands, and the smaller the band is, the more that, you know, they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it for the love of music. And I think even if they, you know, the Coldplay, or not Coldplay, because they're probably too big, but the Fray or the Lumineers, that type level bands, you know, they still do it for the love of music, but they've all made music and they're trying to find ways to still pay their bills and things like that. But yeah, they're not touring is one thing. The supply is kind of been tight. So Europe is having a lot more difficulty with their festivals this summer, even though that's where all the fans are going to, because of the supply of entertainment. Legal restrictions are pretty much ending, especially overseas with the vax passes and testing has ended. But the industry itself is still very fragile. And the cost of operations and infrastructure is 20 to 30% higher this year than it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, the food you're buying for your event is you know, 30% more than it was a year ago, or, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So yeah, that's got to be. Hey, so unless you don't want to step on any toes, which Shellebration act has been your favorite in terms of their performance? Have you had a favorite?
Well, you're asking the wrong person if it's about their performance, because based on my position and what I'm doing there, I don't get to see the show. I'm running around. Might have a power outage in our VIP, or a porta potty that's gotten pushed over, or somebody stuffed something, you know. It's a matter of moving around, or you're talking, you're pressing the flesh and talking to sponsors and people that, you know, you walk through the crowd and you inevitably get hit up by some people, you know.
Sure.
So I don't really have a favorite as far as the events we've done.
Now, how about in terms of who's been the best to work with? I mean, who was really just unbelievably easy and much easier? I mean, has there been anyone like that where you just said, gosh, were they easy? Were they great?
Steve Miller Band was really good. To work off the top of my head. Styx was really friendly. REO back in the day, they were real up front. And, you know, the smaller the band.
Do you get to meet with them? Like, do you meet them at the airport, or do you drive them around or any of that? Or is there someone else that takes care of all that?
So we have somebody on our board. We have a board of 12 to 16, depending on the year, and everybody knows their job. We have people that are in charge of our food and beverage, people that are in charge of our parking, people that are in charge of our hospitality, our VIP area, stage setup, and all that. And so we do have the band hospitality with my wife. We also have drivers that work with band hospitality, and so they're the ones, and they're trusted individuals. And we get, you have to. You know, the requirements are you have to have a Escalade or it has to be black, or a Excursion or some sort of big, you know, sport utility to shuttle these guys in or pick them up at the airport. Sometimes they fly in. We've had them fly right into Fort Dodge Airport.
Yeah.
In fact, is it Sammy Hagar? I don't remember who it was that just recently flew in. Himself in, it might have been Sammy Hagar. I got, or it was Tom Scholl from Boston.
Okay.
But so if we get to meet them, usually a quick, meet and greet. We're too busy. Our whole board's just busy. But we'll try to line up 5 minutes and shuffle through, shake their hand, get our photo taken with them. And then we have them sign our posters every year. And I've got a collection of musical guitars and drum heads and tambourines that I've gotten signed by these bands over the years. So there's a little bit of extra access, if you will. But for the most part, our back stage is quarantined off from everybody else. And you got to leave these alone,
Are there do you have to deal with the groupie types that are hanging around them?
No, we got, there's security for that that deals with that. And it's Fort Dodge. You don't get a whole lot of, most people know the thing. We do sell a ton of merchandise. We've been known to, in Iowa in general, it sells a ton of band merchandise. These bands come through here and they said, I don't know what it is about you guys, the corn you're eating or something, but man, you guys buy a lot of t-shirts and can coolers and we'll sell them out. They come in and such. Just wanted to touch real quick on, you were talking about touring for this year and things like that. And one of the big things to know is, I was saying that these indoor arenas are starting to get the fans back and the diehards are coming back. And the question was, would the casual fans come back? But a lot of it's tied into COVID-related things. Coachella Valley Music and Art Festival, which is probably one of the larger ones in the U.S., they get do about 125,000 people a day, and it's multiple weekends. They've had three postponements, and not only are they coming back, but they've dropped any and all COVID-related precautions for attendees. In other words, no mask, no passport, no vaccine, no testing. So a lot of these festivals, I think, will follow that lead. We have to, for instance, Elton John last week or some of those, we have to get tested. Every backstage person has to get tested in the morning, and they pay for it. They do the simple swab test, and sometimes you have to self-test. That Slipknot festival, we had to test every single morning. Another day for 10 days setting up for that. I worked a show this Sunday. It was a play in Ames, Iowa. It was Hairspray, the musical.
Yeah.
And we had done, I want to say 50% of the load in, maybe a little bit more. We started at 7:30. 11:30, the show was canceled in the morning. And it's, I'm up in the air hanging a light here. This is like, well, I guess I'll just take it down. And you do. We packed it up. It took another 4 hours to pack it all in, but we started our loadout immediately there and there was just no show. And,
unbelievable.
Now as employees, we got paid for that show that didn't happen. We didn't get paid for the extra hours of setup and stuff. So, it bites into you a little bit. But here's the thing. It wasn't for COVID. The audio guy, their audio engineer, had the flu, regular flu. And so they had a backup guy who's a backup audio engineer. These are the guys that run the sound, the flu too.
So they'll
get shut down and fans, or ticket buyers are turned away. And I don't know. It's a weird world, dude.
Yeah, it is, no doubt. Hey, I've got to cut it short. I'm going to actually try and make it. I'm really going to try and make it for this year for Celebration. I actually mentioned it to my wife, and she actually didn't put a kibosh on it or anything like that. So, but in the meantime, hey, I've got another guest coming on, and I've got to prep for him. But in honor of one of your past shows, and in honor of what our guest is going to talk about, I'm going to play a good song for you.
Not a problem, man. I'm just in front of everybody. You're welcome to come visit. You're going to have to be put to work.
It happens. Okay, so I'll do this, and then hang around if you want, because you might like this. I know you'll like this guy. So, but anyway, I'm going to play this off, and we're going to take a quick break, folks, a couple minutes, and then we'll come back with my friend Fred, who's going to talk about cars. So be right back, folks.
Thanks, Hank.
Thanks, Pete. He talked about Sammy Hagar, one of their big players. And of course, it goes well into the car. So, I'll come back to grab you when it's time.
Okay, you're back.
Hank?
Hello, Hank?
He still has me on here, too, but I can't hear him.
Yeah, I can't hear him either, but boy, your conversation was fascinating.
It's an interesting, you know, I've parlayed it into real work because I used to trade stocks. But I love doing it as a part-time, and so that's why I started the stage handing. And I took on a job running the largest Hispanic Latino festival in North America a couple of years ago up in Wisconsin, near Wisconsin Dells. And
I know where it is.
The guy fired me. You know, they lost money. I saved them a couple hundred thousand. I did what I had to do, but it was what I wanted to do with a career, and now I'm just getting old, dude. So I don't know if I'm going to be parlay it into something else now because COVID kind of took all that wind away. But they're going to do that same thing. You're in California?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm out in California.
So let me tell you a little bit about – okay, so my guest right now, my next guest, he probably really can't drive 55. I don't think I've ever seen him drive 55. You can't blame him because he has driven some very sweet vehicles in his lifetime. I met Fred first during our summers in Wisconsin, outside Land Lakes, Wisconsin, back in the late 70s. So I've known him longer than T. Bodie. And while we loved our time on the water and in the woods and later on in the bars, we also liked our time in the road or off the road. And we really loved Tuesday nights, Eagle River, the weekly stock car races. Fred, I got a quick question. Was that a half mile or a quarter mile track there?
Last I checked, it was about a third of a mile.
So
it's
totally
kind of an
wrong.
Odd size.
Okay, I was totally wrong. Then.
It's either a third or three-eighths of a mile.
Okay, and do they still, I mean, remember we would go there and we would split six packs of Stroh's or Old Style. Can you still get that there or no? Are they not, do they not allow you to do
that?
Oh,
no, you can still get beers. I'm trying to remember what they were selling. I know they had PBR.
Naturally.
Which is now a hipster beer, believe it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And I think you can still get Old Style. I don't think it was Liney's original.
Travesty. So Fred,
I know.
To give some background, Fred has a ski nautique and a place in Wisconsin where he can store it, and he has an old Mercedes. Are you still restoring that, your grandfather's Mercedes?
Well, I I'm preserving it. I'm a caretaker of it.
Okay.
A full restoration would cost bucks. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, even though my grandfather would park it during the winters, which is why it survived, because it was technically my grandmother's car, but
okay.
he'd park it in Madison for the winters, but it was still driven on some salted road, so
yeah,
there's a little bit of the tin worm that has to be dealt with. Not bad, but yeah. it's definitely a survivor class. But it runs like a top.
Wow!
Like a top.
So can you give us a little bit about your background in the auto realm? I don't want to say industry, but realm.
Yeah, I started in the car business about 9 months out of college. I graduated with a degree, believe it or not, in agriculture business management.
I remember that.
So naturally, I went into the car business. I spent a year and a half in product planning at Subaru, back when Subaru was a little tiny company with headquarters in New Jersey, and I was working out of a tiny little outpost in Southern California in product planning, and there was about four of us in the product planning group. And then I moved over to Honda's ad agency, so that was a move over to a corporate ad agency, which I had sort of grown up with because of my dad.
Okay.
And then I went from there to Mazda's PR agency, and that's where I spent about 14 years. And I was part of the team that introduced the original Mazda Miata, the third generation RX-7, got to do a lot of driving on various racetracks around the country as part of press events and everything and going to media association events. And then I left there and went back into product planning for Kia. And I was there and I was the program manager for the original Kia Soul, which
wow.
was obviously a big hit for Kia. I was the program manager for the Kia Rio and the Kia Spectra and Forte, because the Forte replaced the Spectra. And so at one point, about half of the company's sales were my product lines.
Man. Nice.
It was great. It was like having my own miniature car company. Because when you're the program manager, you're making design decisions, you're making color and trim decisions, you're making packaging decisions, you're working with the marketing team on how the car is going to be marketed, what features are going to be put forth in the advertising and the catalogs and everything. You're working with the sales division. You know, here's how people are going to sell it. I mean, it's everything soup to nuts.
Wow, that's really okay.
Yeah, I look back at my career and it's like, wow, I did a crap ton load of stuff.
Yeah, you did. So tell us about the Kia pickup that never made it to the lot.
Yes. I wrote a story for a friend's website, pickup truck plus SUV talk. It's like pickuptruck.com. But anyhow, This was a Kia, our product planning group at Kia had been looking at the compact to mid-size pickup. We knew we didn't want to do a full-size pickup and go head-to-head with the Ford F-150 and the Dodge Ram. But we saw an opportunity in the mid-size range, and we thought, okay, we can do that. And sure. So we had a concept car in, I think, 2004 or so at the Chicago Auto Show, and we got good response to it. And so we looked at it some more, and we looked at it some more, and unfortunately, there was one deal breaker. If you can't build a pickup truck in the United States, you have to pay a 25% tariff. And
really?
it's called the chicken tax, and it came out of a trade dispute in the early 60s between the U.S. and what was then West Germany. And basically, West Germany put tariffs on American-grown chickens. And so the U.S. in retaliation, you'll love this, the U.S. in retaliation said, okay, we're going to put a 25% tariff on any imported pickup truck. And at the time, the only imported pickup truck was really coming from Germany in the form of the Volkswagen pickup,
okay.
Which was basically, you know, a Volkswagen van with the back end cut off.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it's the Volkswagen, the VW microbus, or what do they call that?
It was a microbus with a bed in the back, and so. So, of course, Volkswagen said, nine, we will stop selling. And so they stopped selling that. Well, the Japanese, for a while, were able to go, well, we've got enough of a trade advantage, as far as low labor costs and other things. We'll pay the 25% tariff, and we'll bring in these trucks. And that's why you had in the 70s, you had all the Japanese mini trucks.
Yeah. The Subaru Brat is the one I remember.
Well, the Subaru Brat actually didn't have to pay the tariff because if you remember the Brat, it had two rear-facing jump seats.
Yeah.
In the bed. They were technically removable, and that allowed them to avoid the 25% tariff because when I worked at Subaru, that was one of the products we were selling, and I wouldn't let anybody ride in the back of the darn thing. Because it's not safe to ride in the back of an open truck, but there was two jump seats, little grab handles that stuck up so that your passengers could hang on for dear life, which was absolutely hilarious.
Oh yeah,
but because it had the jump seats, according to our wonderful government, it now qualified as a passenger vehicle.
And that wasn't even the Obama administration. So
no, that was actually during the Carter years.
Yeah. Well,
which,
okay. So equally
which
yeah. Okay.
Either people don't remember or don't want to remember.
Yeah. Exactly. So okay. So we're in a weird time now, car wise. Now, not for you because, as you point out, you're still consulting and you're still. People just look him up on Facebook, Fred Akins. He's at a car show. I don't want to say weekly, but darn near weekly.
Pretty much monthly.
So what's going on now? I mean, why? I mean, we're seeing everything. There's a shortage of autos. You hear that people are getting more money for their used cars than they ever, you know, ever dreamed of. In a nutshell, what's happening in the auto industry that's causing all this crazy stuff?
Well, it all pretty much traces back to the pandemic.
Okay.
And COVID. Because what happened with COVID was, if you remember right, March 2020, everything cratered. The economy cratered. Oil prices actually went negative. You know,
the price
of a barrel of oil actually went negative. And so OPEC Plus, they turned off the spigot because there was a glut of oil out there. And then you had all of the chip factories, you know, silicon chips, which are in everything now. Yeah. All of the plants started to have to shut down because of COVID, because as bad as things were here in the States, they were worse in Asia where the chips are made.
Okay.
And so the auto companies, they couldn't get chips. Auto demand dried up. Rent-a-car companies, which make up anywhere about 10 to 15% of the market as far as fleet sales, they stopped buying. They said, nope, we're canceling all of our orders. We don't need cars because nobody's traveling. You know, and everybody went into lockdown. And so
the industry
basically for about 3 to 4 months in 2020 just flat shut down. And plants were idle, and chip plants, suddenly you couldn't get chips. Cars coming in from overseas. The cars that were on the water got stacked up at the ports because the ports couldn't process them.
Okay.
And that's where part of the supply chain nightmare came from. So essentially, it's like somebody took the needle on the record player and just went across the record. Everything stopped.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, people started going, well, wait. A lot of us are working from home, and especially it was middle to upper income people who were still working from home, and they still had money. And they said, well, now's a good time to, you know, buy a car, because at that point the cars that had been built were sitting on dealer lots, and the cars and trucks, people, you know, dealers wanted to get rid of them, so they're going, okay, here, take this new car. We'll sell it. And these relatively wealthy buyers are going, okay, I'll buy that. Because the one place that you were most safe, if you had to go out, the one place you were most safe was in a private vehicle. You weren't safe on public transportation. You certainly weren't safe in the air.
Yeah.
But you were safe in your own private car. So all of a sudden, America started traveling again. And that's when you got into these people like, you know, the van life people who are going out and going to national parks because, again, the one place you were relatively safe was out in the middle of nowhere breathing fresh air.
Sure, sure.
So people started doing that. And so the auto industry began to reawaken. And that's when they discovered that there was a chip shortage. And so car companies, especially on their bigger, fancier models, which have more silicon chips, or they'd have to delay production, or they'd have to shut down production until they could get a reliable source of chips. And, of course, the other thing that people did in the pandemic was they started buying electronics.
Yep. They sure
did. Okay, well, we're stuck at home. We're gonna, you know, I'm gonna buy a new tablet. I'm gonna buy a new big screen TV, et cetera, et cetera. And the chip makers are going, well, you know, we've got contracts to supply these guys. We'll supply them. And then the auto companies would come and say, well, we need more chips. And they go, we're out of production capacity because we're still running at half. We're still running at half capacity because half of our workforce is out sick.
Yeah. And during that time,
lockdowns.
Yeah. And of course, during that time, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos loved the lockdown. Why? And Mark Zuckerberg, especially. Why? Well, Facebook carries roughly 20% of the world's internet traffic. Amazon sells through that. And Amazon by themselves also runs a hell of a lot of, internet traffic through their AWS models. And then of course, Microsoft and Apple too, but you know, people were buying stuff. So so the chip industry didn't really die per se. It sort of shifted its focus at that point. Cause obviously there were still chips needed.
Right. There were still chips needed. And the other thing that the auto industry suddenly discovered is, you know, the auto industry is a big deal globally. Except next to electronics and companies like Amazon, which dwarf just dwarf, you know, big tech dwarfs big auto in terms of market cap and everything else. And
we never would have said, we never would have believed that would happen 40 years ago.
No. And at that point, it's like, well, everybody's on a Zoom call, so you need chips and everything for Zoom calls and net meetings and everything else. And eventually they sort of said, well, the auto industry realized, okay, we've got a weakness here because the auto industry is also transitioning from conventional combustion vehicles to electric vehicles. And electric vehicles require even more chips because
– Oh, they do? Okay. That was going to be a question.
Oh, yeah.
That was going to be one of the questions.
Well, you look at some of these – you look at some of these electric vehicles like a Tesla, like a Lucid Air, like the new Rivian R1T pickup truck, and they're basically a smartphone with wheels in terms of the number of screens inside, in terms of the number of functions. You get into what I've some of the technology that I've tested is what's called advanced driver assistance systems, ADAS.
Okay, right.
And ADAS is what makes possible eventually autonomous driving, which is what everybody in Silicon Valley wants us to move toward. And because here's why. It's not because they want to save lives by reducing accidents and no longer having a human behind the wheel. Because right now, if you have a human behind the wheel, what's that person not doing or shouldn't be doing? They should be using their phone.
Yeah.
And so that person behind the wheel, they're not generating data that that big tech can monetize.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let me – here's my question then. So they literally the chip in a car – is the same as the chip in a computer, so to speak. I mean, I assume there's some differences, but basically that's...
Right. Right. A silicon chip is a silicon chip, and whether it goes into a smartphone or a smart TV or a smart vacuum cleaner, it's
or a
chip.
Smart car.
And in a car, you have chips to run the audio infotainment system. You've got chips to run your anti-lock brakes, your stability control, all these other electronic functions, your automatic emergency braking, your radar cruise control, everything. Everything is run by chips. In fact, on some cars, you no longer have a mechanical connection between the steering wheel and the steering rack or the front wheels, it's all digital. Your transmissions are digitally controlled. Your brakes are digitally controlled. So the auto industry went all the way down this path of, okay, let's automate all these functions, and then all of a sudden they couldn't get chips. That's begun to come back, but that's why you see these spot shortages and why all of a sudden, you know, GM just announced that they're shutting down production of the Silverado, Chevy Silverado and GMC Sierra pickup trucks. Now, those are cash cows. Those trucks generally make about $10,000 in profit. Each truck makes $10,000 in profit, roughly, for the manufacturer. They've shut down the most profitable line so that they can put the chips that they've got available into their new Hummer EV, which comes out this spring. So they're gonna build the Hummer EV, which is a $110,000 electric truck. But they're not building the $40,000 and $50,000 Chevy Silverados.
Well, nobody said GM was smart. I mean, GM had to get more, TARP money and everything back then. So here's a question. You know,
sure.
Everyone's feeling the pain at the pump now. Everyone's hearing about car shortages. If somebody's going out to buy a car right now, is there an advantage that you should be – should you be looking at used versus new, or should you be looking at new? Or, you know, I mean, is there an advantage one way or the other right now?
If you can, my first advice is if you can, wait 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
Because
okay.
Right now everything is overpriced.
Okay.
I'm seeing stuff on the used side where they're getting prices that a year ago people would have said you're high on crack.
Yeah.
If you think you're going to get that kind of money for a car that old. But if you absolutely need a car, be prepared to pay through the nose for it. I think one statistic I read said that 82% of all new vehicle sales in the last couple of months, like the last 3 months or so, went for over sticker price. It's never been that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, typically, you know, you can get a car, and I've helped people do this, where sticker price, if you pay sticker price, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And you can negotiate, you know, $1,000, $2,000, sometimes even $4,000 less than sticker if you know how to negotiate. Right now, if a dealer has a vehicle, you know, the salesperson might get fired if they sell it for sticker.
Okay.
Much
okay.
Less
in other
low
words,
sticker.
Yeah. I mean, they can almost entertain a bidding war on vehicles. Then it sounds like
they can and they do.
Okay. Now
there will be people who will follow the truck to the dealership and start bidding on the cars that are on the truck if they aren't already spoken for.
Okay. Now, take us through this one. Again, let's talk about the person that money's not an object, or let's talk about a scenario where, you know, all vehicles are available. What specific? Okay, you say they're wanting us to go to electric. Are we still always going to have gas and diesel engines, or is that really going to be gone 20 years from now?
If you listen to the politicians, California's Governor Newsom. There's a couple of states that have said we're going to ban the sale of gas-fueled vehicles after 2030 or 2035. Those proclamations are great, but it's also some of the best comedy ever written.
Yeah.
Because if you start thinking about it, you go, wait a minute. Right now, the only electric pickup truck that's on the market right now is from Rivian. It's a mid-size pickup. It's about the size of a Ford Ranger.
Okay. So
that's the only, you know, that's the only pickup truck. That's the only electric pickup truck, fully electric.
Okay.
Now, Ford's got the F-150 Lightning coming this spring. But right now, there's just one. Well, pickup trucks make up roughly a quarter of the new vehicle market,
yeah.
Full-size pickup trucks. Well, do
and they hold their resale. They hold their resale as well, correct?
Oh,
they hold
absolutely.
Their value.
So you're going to go from one entry in 2022 to, well, think about it.
Yeah.
25% of the market in
2035
8 to 13 years. The math doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
But here's the thing. You look at Governor Newsom and his proclamation, and what he basically did was he was putting out a stake and pounding it into the ground and saying, this is our goal. By the time that goal gets close and is actually and you know buyers actually have to sign up for that, Governor Newsom's going to be in retirement by then. He will have termed out, and hopefully, you know, who knows what his future plans are, but he will have termed out, and it's entirely possible his political career will be over. So he doesn't have to live with the consequences
exactly.
of his proclamation. which is what a lot of politicians do.
Yeah. So then on the electric vehicle side, I mean, you've said before, you know, less moving parts and stuff. What about hybrid? Is that still going to be a going thing, or is that just being phased out because of electric?
Well, right now, hybrids are, for a lot of people, they're the best solution.
Okay.
Because with a hybrid, especially a plug-in hybrid, you can plug in overnight and charge up, and you've got a full charge, and that full charge will get you 50 or 70 miles. Well, the average person, their commute is 20 to 40 miles. So they can drive a plug-in hybrid and never buy a tank of gas unless they go on a long trip. Now, with a full EV, the best ones out there are somewhere around 250 to 300 miles of range. But then when you stop to recharge, it's not like pulling up to a gas pump and pumping gas for 5 minutes, and then you've got another 250 to 300 miles worth of range. You've got to sit there for anywhere between 45 minutes to 4 hours.
Well, yeah.
So think about like filling up your gas tank using a teaspoon, one teaspoon at a time. Think of how long that would take you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Not a fun scenario.
So for most people, especially people who occasionally, let's say you want to go from Iowa City up to Land O'Lakes, that's about 350, 400 miles.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, about 350.
In an electric car, it'll take you, with a stop to recharge, it'll take you the better part of a day. I can do it in 6 hours.
Yeah. Well, most of us do it in 7, but you can do it in 6. I get it. So.
Well, that's why it was appropriate to play
out
the drive 55.
Right. Exactly. So hybrids are the solution there. But what about, then you talk about autonomous vehicles. You know, and we've heard the stories of, as you said, the guy behind the wheel can't be consuming can't be consuming data, et cetera. You know, I've heard people use the argument of, if you're in an autonomous vehicle, you can be playing on your tablet or whatever. But then we've heard the horror stories of the autonomous vehicle that goes into the back of a semi, so to speak. So, yeah, it's not much.
Yeah, right.
To me, there's not much consolation. Yeah, there's not much consolation in my final 30 seconds saying, I'm going into the ass end of a semi at 80 miles an hour, but thank God I got to play on my tablet. I mean, I just don't see that as a big selling point. Are we really going to be, is autonomous really going to happen or not?
It might happen in my lifetime and your lifetime, but it's not going to happen anywhere near as quickly as the boffins in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
Think it's going to happen. And it's not going to happen nearly as fast as Wall Street is betting that it's going to happen.
Okay.
Because if you think about it, first thing that all of these autonomous vehicles require is lots of data.
Okay.
And, I mean, they've got lots of data going for all of the sensors to read the road conditions, to if they have things like LIDAR, which is basically a laser imaging of the road ahead, they've got to be able to communicate with other vehicles. That's called V2V. They've got to be able to communicate to the surrounding matrix or grid. That's called V2X.
Okay.
All of that requires at least 5G capability. Well, we don't have 5G capability everywhere right now.
Right, right.
And some
places are actually fighting it.
Despite what the cell phone companies say, or the telecommunications companies say, 5G is not, it's not going to be a finger snap. It's not going to be completely nationwide. next month, even next year.
Okay.
So right now the system can't even support. The other thing that autonomous vehicles really require is good infrastructure, including road signs and lines on the road. Well, what has this country done for the last 40-plus years? We've underinvested in our infrastructure. And despite the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that got passed and signed last year, that's not going to change anytime soon, because that's dealing with the hardware, the roads and bridges and stuff. Niceties like road signs and making sure that they're all autonomous vehicle compliant.
Right, right.
That's still well out in the future. That's a decade or more out.
Okay. So we're not talking.
You need a vehicle. No. You need a vehicle that can actually read the roadsides and everything. You know, people will say, well, what about Tesla's autopilot, or what about Tesla's full self-driving? Tesla itself has admitted that its full self-driving is at best a level two system. Well, level two is essentially smart cruise control.
Okay. So it's not.
I've driven Tesla vehicles with autopilot. I haven't driven a Tesla with full self-driving, but I've driven Tesla vehicles with autopilot, and they are about as accomplished as, well, either your 80-year-old grandmother behind the wheel or your 16-year-old niece.
Yeah.
In other words, they're really, really timid. There's a story of an autonomous vehicle. I think it was one of the Google ones down in Arizona, where basically it came to a road cone.
Call in now.
That was.
Call in.
And it basically froze.
Call in.
The road cone. Yeah. The Google vehicle saw the cone, and I think it had gotten knocked out from the line of cones. So it had gotten knocked into the traffic lane, and the Google vehicle froze and couldn't proceed. And the safety driver eventually, after backing up traffic for about 5 minutes, had to manually override the system and drive the Google vehicle around one single orange cone in the roadway. Like I said, it's the equivalent of a newly licensed driver who doesn't know what the hell to do in most situations, or if anything goes a little bit amiss. Which is why
my dreams of being on the, like, in a Jetsons car are not going to happen in my lifetime.
Depends on how long you live.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm going strictly on averages here, so
I don't expect to see anything approaching autonomous vehicles, at least out on the open road with all of the other drivers around them, until 2045 or 2050. And that might be overly optimistic.
Man.
Let's put it this way. I'm hoping that autonomous vehicles are ready by the time I'm ready to hand over my driver's license.
Okay. So at that point, yeah, then it would be convenient, obviously.
At that point, I could still get up to the lake.
Yeah. Now, what about, with all this stuff we're talking about, gas mileage, you know, you're always hearing about, you know, obviously, like I said, the pain of the pump. Are there certain vehicles that really shine in the gas mileage right now? Are there some cars that people, like, somebody that can afford a car and is ready to buy a car, is there a car that gets better, or that shines gas mileage wise or not?
Well, there's cars like the Toyota Prius,
okay,
which, you know, they get really, really good gas mileage. I have several friends who have Priuses, and as much as I rib them about them, and around, I basically say, look, as long as you stay out of my way in the fast lane, you know,
yeah,
God love you. Just
okay.
Move right. Get over to the right. But
do they not drive fast? You mean like they're not fast enough?
Oh, no, no, no. The problem is not with the Prius itself. The problem is with a lot of the buyers of the Prius.
Okay. Okay.
You know those people who insist on virtue signaling even when you don't want them to? Well,
yep.
Prius drivers basically virtue signal, like, I'm saving the planet, and at least here in California, they camp out in the left lane, in the fast lane, and they want you to suffer along with them in the fast lane at the speed limit, or five or 10 miles over the speed limit, and they refuse to move over.
Yeah, and that's not fair, obviously. But hey, Fred, we've got a caller on who has a question. You know him, you've met him, brother Tommy, my little brother from the same mother and father, who you remember, of course. Brother Tommy,
absolutely.
What's up, man?
Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Yes, so I can hear you.
Okay, good. I missed it. Yeah, Hank was disconnected and whatnot. I'm going to go totally off the rails vis-a-vis what you guys are talking about. Fred, I think we're clear on the name that we can use, or clear on the fact that we can use Fred's name, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you did it earlier, because I know you always are like incognito when it comes to names and whatnot. Yeah, Fred, I used to Facebook you until I got disgusted with Facebook, and I got to hit you a question because Hank did it with the cars and whatnot. Now, what is your prognosis on Mercedes when it comes to F1? Now, I used to fucking hate F1, thought it was a joke. My middle boy really loves F1, and so to me, it's like it's become an addiction. F1 for the listeners is Formula One car racing. Fred, I'll give you the.
First of all, Tom, I'm glad you're an F1 fan. If you're a Mercedes fan this year, I'm sorry.
No, I've never been a Mercedes fan. No, you misunderstood me. If I said that, I've never been. My boy loves Vettel. And so now Vettel, as you know, went to the English team?
Aston Martin.
Yeah.
Over at Aston Martin. Well,
my boy loves him. I've never loved everyone loves Hamilton, I think is his name, right?
Yeah, Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah,
seven
and he's a golden child. If I implied that, I fucked up. But I'm asking you, do you think they're going to make up the first race they were in third place? Do you think Mercedes, and ultimately will Mercedes still be the top team?
This year, I don't know that they're going to be the top team, at least in the first half of the season, because it seems like Ferrari and Red Bull.
Yeah.
Verstappen. Right now, Ferrari and Red Bull seem to have the hot setup. The first two races have been absolutely wonderful compared to what were essentially parades the last several years.
I agree with that.
Nobody could pass. The aerodynamics were all messed up. And usually it was Mercedes winning 1-2, and then there's a big gap back to third.
Do they hold on to that monopoly? I guess is my question. Do they hold on to that monopoly this year? Yes or no?
It doesn't look like it.
My boy said what Ferrari did is he said they knew that they were doing these changes, aerodynamical changes, and he said Ferrari consciously made a choice to sacrifice last year. Do you buy any? Do you see any credence into that argument? He's like Ferrari consciously made a choice.
Absolutely. Ferrari was mid pack at best last year.
Right.
Okay, so let's say Ferrari did that. They sacrificed last year to be at the front of the grid this year, which seems to be working.
Right. That's my boy's argument.
How do you explain Red Bull? Because they won the championship last year with Verstappen.
Verstappen won, but did the team win it or did Mercedes win? I think Mercedes won. I could be wrong.
Mercedes won the constructors' title, but that's based on the finishes of both of the drivers, and Mercedes drivers with Hamilton and Bottas were better than
Bottas left, right?
Verstappen,
Bottas left.
Verstappen and I think it was Perez. Yeah, Bottas is now over at Alfa Romeo.
Bottas left too, right.
Right. He actually wound up finishing higher, I think, than Hamilton in this last race because he's got a Ferrari engine.
And let me ask you another quick question, because I think you've kind of answered my question. Is you're every bit as in the dark as I am on this one. How good – I want to ask you two questions, and then I'll let it go back to Hank. How good is Hamilton, and how good is Vettel in your world? Because you are obviously somewhat of a car expert. Oh, F1 expert.
Okay. Well, obviously, Hamilton is a 7-time world champion, so he is probably –
Is that a result of him or Mercedes, though? That's my question.
Let him go.
Well, if you look at it, he's in an uncompetitive car at Mercedes this year, or a car that's mid-pack, at least in qualifying, and he finished third in the first race. That should tell you something.
What I'm asking you, Fred, though, is in a roundabout way, is he Michael Jordan or is he not? That's my only question. Is he the best of the best in his profession or is he not? And then my follow-up question is Vettel. My youngest or my middle boy argues Vettel is.
I would disagree with your son because I think Hamilton, as near as I can tell, is for his era, for this era, he is the best of the best and he is still the gold standard when it comes to as a driver.
I thought Schumacher was.
Now,
correct me.
Well, okay, Schumacher is probably one of the greatest ever. But Hamilton is at least in that same discussion. Vettel had some great years with Red Bull, but once he went to Ferrari, that's where he fucked up.
Right.
Where he had superior equipment. If you look at the last few years of Vettel's career, he's made a slew of unforced errors. What they call it, you know, in
yeah,
tennis, they call
I've
them
seen
unforced
that. Yes,
errors.
Tennis, right. Tennis analogy,
there were some races where it looked like he was fully in control, and there were some seasons where it looked like, okay, he's going to be vying for the championship, and then he or as a team had a couple of really real clinkers midway through the season, and all of a sudden they just faded. And
yeah, I wanted aforementioned middle boy, I wanted him to call in, and I called him up and I said, hey, Hank's got Fred Akins coming on, and he knows everything about F1, and he's like, I can't do it. He's got an engineering club tonight and all of that. But I would have loved to have him heard your perspective on this. But, yeah, it's fascinating. So you're saying Vettel is not a pretender, but certainly not tops of contenders. It seems like they're arguing.
Yeah. Vettel, I think the problem with Vettel is when he went to Ferrari, he lost some of his edge. And because he realized that he lost his edge, he started pressing. You know,
which
in baseball,
is
when
all
a pitcher
people
starts,
do in sports. Yeah.
Right.
Not
when
all,
a pitcher
most,
starts
right.
Over, right. When a pitcher starts overthrowing the ball.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
All
when
of
people
a, all
overanalyze,
of
they're
sudden,
fucked.
The fact,
they're fucked in the brain. Right.
Right. Their fastball doesn't have the same bite. The curveball flattens out, and they get shelled. And last couple of years at Ferrari.
And you think that's
Vettel,
what happened to Vettel?
Yeah, Vettel got shelled at Ferrari. And I think he either lost his edge or he lost his self-confidence. And I hope he gets it back because he's still a hell of a driver, and he's a four-time world champion.
Now, but I asked you on Facebook once, and I hate to go back to this because I forget. It's a shot on my memory. But I asked you on Facebook once, who's your favorite driver, or do you have a favorite driver, A, of all time, and B, present day?
Oh, boy. Favorite driver of all time, it's got to be Mario Andretti.
No,
AJ
I'm saying
Foyt.
F1. Not,
Mike,
yeah, no, I'm saying
oh,
F1. I'm
F1.
Not saying.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm saying
then,
F1.
Then probably Schumacher. Although, Schumacher or Senna. Schumacher or Senna. But both of them, in tight situations, they would drive very much elbows out. And they, both of
for
them
those non-listeners that don't understand what we're talking about, elbows out means they drive to the wire. Am I right there, Fred?
Yeah. Basically, they would either one of those guys would put their mother into the wall if it meant winning the race.
Well, I'll tell you what, Fred. I had a boss, I shit you not about this, that said that he's like, who was the most, I'm going back 20 years thereabouts, who was the most grandiose, who made the most money as far as sports athletes going? I said, well, obviously Mike Tyson, because I'm going back 20 years. He says, well, no. He said, you're wrong. Schumacher. He said they literally put cap on his head. They put a cap on his head, and for his 30-second interview, he got like $3 million for it. And I'm not fucking with you. I'm being totally serious. Is that crazy, or can you validate that?
No, I can't validate that particular anecdote. But Michael Schumacher, the money that he was making at Ferrari.
He was making $50 million a year.
Yeah,
people
making,
don't realize
making
it.
$50 million, and that's just in salary from the team. That's excluding all of his other endorsements.
Right,
so
that's what I'm saying, and that's what my boss told me. He's like, you don't realize it, dummy. This guy, this is when I started becoming somewhat familiar with F1. It takes $6 million to do a car in the Daytona 500. It's like $250 million for a F1 car, and those numbers are not that far off.
No,
people don't realize it.
Right, $100 million buys you a spot at the back of the grid.
Right, but people don't realize
it's like
what the hell?
Somebody comes to F1 and goes, I have $100 million budget, and F1 basically
they're like,
goes,
all right, shut the fuck up, dummy.
Right, here's one white chip. Take a seat. you get one white chip and a seat at the table.
Hey, let me quickly change it. I know Hank probably wants me to get off here, but let me quickly change it. Are you going to be up in BOL this summer?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to do it. I can't claim that I will do it. I'm unfortunately poor, but love to do it. God damn it. I would love to see you, and that's great. I'm sorry?
Well, where are you based normally?
I'm Tampa, Florida.
Okay, so you guys are mid-Florida. At some point, I keep telling my wife we're going to go down there and visit some family and friends.
If you get to Tampa, give me a call or tell your sister, Ruthie, I want to say, tell her to give me a call, too. I would absolutely love it. And, Hank, I'm sorry to
not a problem.
Take it over, but
I got to get back to it.
I love F1. I love F1, and I've grown an affinity for F1, and I know that Fred knows F1, and that's why I kind of hogged the show a little bit there.
Okay. not a problem. So we're going to get back to it. Brother Tommy, thanks for calling in, man.
You got it, buddy.
Brother Tommy is into Formula One because of his son. Okay, so Fred, a couple more quick questions because we're up on the top of our time here, but I have a couple.
Okay.
We've talked about trucks and EVs. Now, not historically, but in my world, so to speak, there's always been one of these thoughts of, you know, you can't make electric vehicles can't be powerful to power like an SUV or a pickup, and they couldn't tow, as an example, towing capacity. Is that a valid thought or not? Are we past all that?
Oh, no, because EVs, in fact, the greatest advantage of EVs is their low-end torque. And torque is what gets the trailer moving.
Okay.
The problem is, and this we're just now discovering this because, again, there's only one EV pickup out there right now.
Okay.
And they actually did a towing test with a Rivian, and I think it was about a 3,500 or 4,000-pound trailer. So nothing too huge. But basically, the Rivian has about a 300-mile range normally, a little over 300 miles. With this trailer attached, they were basically going 100 to 125 miles.
Okay, so it drops
charges.
It. Okay.
So it drops it considerably. So what you're going to have, and Ford just did a trailer towing test where they did on I-70, it's called the Eisenhower Gauntlet because it goes up through the Eisenhower Tunnel at the summit of I-70. I've gone through that. I've gone through that with our F-150 with a boat on the back of it. By the way, we had about a foot of clearance between the top of the tower and the top of the tunnel.
Lovely.
That'll get your attention.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
When you start looking in the mirror, you're going, oh, there's not that much clearance, is there?
No.
But so when we tow with our F-150, our fuel economy drops from say 21 miles to the gallon to about 14.
Okay.
So we lose.
So you lose about a third.
We lose about a third of our fuel. About a third of our fuel economy. Right now, the best estimates I've seen, and again, there's not that much data out there. The best estimates I've seen with EVs is that they lose about 40 to 50%.
Okay.
Well, that's a much bigger number than
absolutely
33%.
Yeah.
And because of the time it takes them to recharge versus, you know,
right, the fill up
in the gas station, you know, pumping in regular. All of a sudden, if you're going cross country with an EV,
you're done.
You need to plan for a week.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Because you'll be able to go. You'll be able to go probably in a 12-hour day, 600 miles.
Okay.
In a 12-hour day, I can go at least 800 or 900 miles in our truck.
Okay. Okay.
I got to cut it
short because we're out of time, but I'd love to have you back. This was fascinating. Some good comments in the chat room about it, how informative it was. And had a great talk with T. Bodie. But yeah, I'd love to have you back on. So we'll talk again. But thanks for being
on.
Fred Akins. Fred Akins with All You Need to Know About Cars, and we would never cover it as much as he knows. Thanks to Fred. Thanks to T. Bodie for being on. And as somebody just said in the chat room, we got killed by the BTR lady, which means we're out. But, hey, man, we'll talk again later, and thanks for being on.
Well, thank you, Hank.
Okay.
I had fun.
Thank you. We'll talk later.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, folks. Folks, thanks for being on. If you're still hearing me, great. If not, please know that I appreciate you all being here. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.